Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast for 6, 7 and 8 figure Amazon and e-commerce sellers, a part of the amazing FBA family. If you want to scale fast, target a 7 figure exit and enjoy the process, then keep listening. Today's episode is sponsored by the new e-commerce podcast, The E-commerce Leader, co-hosted by myself, Michael Veazey, and Jason Miles, top 1% Shopify store owner and Udemy's highest rated e-commerce instructor. If you're the owner of a thriving e-commerce business, look for The E-commerce Leader on your favorite podcast app and subscribe today. Ladles and jelly spoons, boys and girls, he says, nicking shamelessly from Tim Ferriss. This is Michael Veazey from Amazing FBA. Delighted today to be talking to Will Churnland of Goat Consulting. Goat Consulting helps brands and manufacturers sell better on Amazon. And Will is, I think, sort of like a street smart economist mixed with an Amazon specialist, a very cool person to talk to. So, Will, great to have you back, my friend.
It's awesome to be here.
Really enjoy our discussions because you have that ability to move from the real detailed knowledge of Amazon all the way to the biggest of big pictures. I think today we're going to be talking about a blend between big picture and Amazon level, right? Because we're talking about fulfillment, which we've always found a sort of slightly dull subject that wasn't particularly relevant to growing businesses, has suddenly become really the bane slash the center of all e-commerce sellers' lives. Suddenly we're obsessed with it. So tell me what your view is of the overall situation on the ground right now. We're talking in November 2020.
All right. This might get a little long-winded, but this is from what I've heard. And so take it as what it is. But Amazon, if you read The Everything Store, which is written probably a decade ago now, kind of chronicles what Jeff was up to and what his thought process was as he's building Amazon. And one of the things they mentioned as kind of the big Amazon master plan was make it as easy as possible for third-party sellers to sell on their platform by handling all the annoying parts like fulfillment and returns. If we can do that, we can then start from the top of the list, source those products ourselves, create our own version of this product, and basically have all of these third-party sellers pay us to do market research for us to figure out what the customers actually want, so then we can supply those products. And so for a while there, say 2013, 2014, 2015, a main kind of business plan for Amazon was essentially to have sellers do a certain amount of revenue on Seller Central. Once you got to $1 million a year, $2 million a year, $3 million a year, then the next step was to invite you over to Vendor Central, where then Amazon could buy the product from you, choose what they're sold at, know that the sales volume and velocity is going to be good because they've already seen your third-party sales, and they could kind of start from this, do it that way. And though Amazon had always said their third-party and first-party, their Vendor Central and Seller Central were separate, that was kind of essentially the plan. Now, a couple years ago, the person who was in charge of Vendor Central left. And the person of Seller Central came in. And the person from Seller Central started running Vendor Central and saw that they are wildly unprofitable. They are buying refrigerators for $500 and selling them for below retail price. And then they're having to ship this refrigerator twice. And it's just these super unprofitable sales that essentially is making it so they can provide more customers with a larger catalog, but at a lower cost. And so the head of Seller Central said, okay, let's get rid of basically all vendors who are not doing at least, say, $10 million a year in sales. All the rest of them are kind of more just wasting our time and not allowing us to scale as fast as we'd like to. So they say, we want to call all the vendors. So I don't know if you remember, I think it was it March this year or March last year when a bunch of vendors just didn't get purchase orders on a Monday? And Amazon said it was a glitch at first and then said move to Seller. So they kind of called a bunch of people there. And then the idea is that you pay your 14% or so to Amazon immediately on Seller Central. Plus you pay between 20 and 30, maybe 40% ACOS to sell that item. And then they can make a clean 40, 50% margin on your product without ever having to dole out any cash. And then the only thing they have to do is stay on top of fulfillment, make fulfillment be break even for them. And Seller Central will grow like crazy. Amazon will be profitable like crazy. And everything is well in the world. Well, This was a great plan until March, April hits with COVID, because they had just been ramping up for the last year or so to have as many sellers as possible inside their fulfillment centers using Fulfillment by Amazon and Seller Central and the third-party sellers as like their fastest growing section of their business, faster than AWS. So what happened was COVID, they had to shut down the warehouses. They couldn't allow any more inventory to be sent into their warehouses unless it was essential. They're totally packed. I've heard multiple times that they've grown like 3 years in the last 3 months based on their projections. And so now it's really interesting because a couple of different things. First, Amazon would love for people to have Merchant Fulfilled and Merchant Fulfilled Prime, which is great and all for Amazon margin-wise, but it also takes away some of the value Amazon's adding through their fulfillment centers, and it's taking away some of kind of their moat that they have. And so that's kind of worrying for Amazon. And then also it's interesting coming from the point of view of people like Shopify are going out, and during this COVID, they are actually saying, hey, if you want to sign up for our services, we'll actually give you a discount right now, because we know there's a lot of people out of work who might be wanting to start an online business. And so they're actually accelerating their onboarding of new sellers because they're trying to get as many sellers as they can on their platform. Where Amazon, I've been hearing the exact opposite. I've been hearing that some people internationally have even had to do like Zoom calls to get their seller accounts set up and such. And that a few years ago, you could just create a seller account within 2 seconds. And now it's becoming more of a cumbersome process. And we've actually dealt with some people who've contacted us recently looking for Amazon help, where we've had to tell them, I would just wait till January, because right now the fulfillment centers are full. They don't want any new SKUs. They don't want new sellers on their platform. And they're just trying to play catch up right now. And so we're at a really interesting moment right now where if Amazon's not going to allow new sellers and it's not going to be the go-to place for new sellers for the time being, this is the perfect time for maybe one of their competitors to try to slide in there, especially as these other sellers try to enhance their third-party fulfillment opportunities. And so we're at this really interesting point right now where Amazon, for its first time ever, is trying to slow down its growth. And it is at the same time as obviously e-commerce is going crazy. So it's a juxtaposition between the two.
Fascinating. I love this. You're the perfect person to talk to about this, because you have a great knack of the way you see things, like sort of street smart economist, as I always put it with you, which is, by the way, you do have an economics degree, as I understand, so not just street economist. This makes a lot of sense. What you've just said, though, if you put those two things together, is very simple, that e-commerce is exploding, so the market per se is just growing huge amount this year, and Amazon is trying to slow down for the first time ever. Therefore, their market share of e-commerce is by definition not only going down, but they are actively for the moment being forced to do that, because otherwise the machine would break. And so this is, as you say, this is new territory for everyone, because the big picture has always been the story that's been stable for really 2 decades, which is kind of crazy. It's okay, e-commerce is going to grow about 15% a year, maybe it's 10, maybe it's been a little bit more, and Amazon's share of it is going to stay stable or slightly grow over time. And that's been true for 2 decades, right? And suddenly that story has changed. So what do you think, where do we even go from here? I mean, what let's deal first of all with the threats and then the opportunities. So the threats to those who are on third-party sellers on Amazon, let's assume that they are Seller Central for the purposes of this. What are the threats and how do we deal with that? I mean, I'm talking about logistical sort of and fulfillment type threats.
So if you can have Merchant Fulfilled Prime, or you can have some sort of Merchant Fulfilled shipped ones and two capabilities, that's great to have, especially if you can do it yourself opposed to paying for a third party. Once you pay for a third party to ship ones and twos, especially if your item's like $20 or $15, it can be very difficult to make any sort of profit still. But I think it's going to be still, that's the interesting thing with Amazon slowing down. It's still Amazon's everything store. It's still king. So I might go to Nike.com and buy a pair of Nike shoes. I may go to Apple.com and buy a new iPhone. But then if you look at my yearly spend, it's like, okay, I spend $1,000 a year with Apple. I spend $200 a year with Nike. I spend $5,000 a year with Amazon. $4,000 with being a business owner and buying other stuff and that kind of thing. And so it still has the everything store kind of behind it, as people think of it as it has everything. And it's still going to have the largest annual customer revenue per customer. It's still going to have the largest cart sizes because it does have everything. But I think more and more, there's a thing where if you're buying based on the brand, there's that much more of a chance that you're going to buy from the brand's actual website. Where if you're just browsing for a widget or a generic kind of commodity, or you just don't know what brand you want, then Amazon will still be king. And so it's these D2C brands that are very brand oriented are going to be able to be the most successful without Amazon, because people are going to search all birds. They're not going to search all natural wool shoes on Amazon.
Interesting. So all birds, not sort of generic search term. I mean, I guess, yeah. It sounds like an obvious thing to say, but I just want to say my experience of the idea of brand on Amazon. Everyone talks about brand building, but you only have a brand when people search by your brand name rather than a generic search term, right? And most people I know who just starting off on Amazon obviously don't have that brand awareness. And to our previous conversation as well, you were talking about it's very hard to justify billboards or any form of marketing that gets you brand awareness but doesn't give you a dollar return. But the interesting thing is that eventually, I guess you can begin to measure that, right? Because people type your brand name into Google, Amazon, whatever other search engine they're using, right?
I'm with you with the kind of pseudo brand thing. It's like, okay, so you sell a garlic smasher. I could go up to 10,000 people in Times Square in New York City and ask if they've heard of your brand. And of course, everyone would say no. And then I could almost go to 1,000 of your past customers and ask them if they know what brand their garlic smasher is. So, like, let's not kid ourselves with the brand thing. It's either you're building a real brand or you're selling widgets.
And by the way, what you've articulated, though, makes so having dealt with that reality, sorry, guys, if you're listening and that naive still, then that's reality. But what you just said, though, is there is much more value suddenly in a real brand, or suddenly, but that is, you know, the trend is there in, say, at Nike, Amazon, or Bird's shoes or whatever those things are. All birds. One day I will buy myself a pair and wander around a US airport and look cool. But never come across those in the UK. But the point is, for people who love those weird wool shoe things, that's a brand, it's a thing. I never heard of it. So you've either got that connection or you haven't. And if you have it, then in the new world, you might get the direct to your store traffic, which is a completely different business model to selling on a marketplace. But if you haven't got that, I guess if we are still in that sort of hinterland of you're being generic keyword driven for your sales, or your, so to put it better, your traffic is coming from generic keyword searches, to be more precise, what should we be thinking about in terms of fulfillment side? Let's come back to sort of the basic brass tacks here. So it's got to be FBMs, preferably seller fulfilled prime. How do we need to go about keeping the goods moving during this FBA overcapacity situation?
Yeah, just to kind of put a cherry on top of our last conversation, the last value in brand too is just being able to tell a friend. It's really hard to tell a friend about a garlic smasher on Amazon. You should check it out too. It's really easy for me to say, I got these Nikes. You should buy Nikes too. They're great. So the brand makes the sharing that much easier. But back to the fulfillment. Yeah, in a perfect world, you would have your own warehouse and you'd send in FBA inventory once a week. And that way you'd never have too much in inventory, but at the same time, you would never have too little. I was just reading an article about some guy who lost like $1 million worth of like random clothing because Amazon destroyed all of his inventory because they said it was counterfeit. And so, yeah, you never want to have all your inventory at Amazon if that's possible, especially because the fees are going up. But yeah, if you could have a merchant fulfilled possibility with you sending in FBA shipments on a weekly basis, that's the best kind of hybrid model, because then you're always in stock prime, but never too much. And if you ever do have a crazy day where sales go nuts, you still have a merchant fulfilled listing in the background, still fulfilling orders for customers.
By the way, that's quite the horror story you just slipped in there. Somebody had $1 million worth of stuff destroyed as counterfeit. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So I guess that's yet another reminder that there's good reasons to stay out of Amazon, because the shoot first, ask questions later mentality is still with us, right?
The quick little side note is it's unclear if he actually was selling counterfeit or not from the article. He claims he's not, but who knows? And then also Amazon they said in an article, like Amazon had emailed him like 5 times that they're going to destroy his inventory. And he kept just like trying to like contact lawyers, trying to figure out who he could get to like talk to Amazon. And in the meantime, they just destroyed his inventory because he took too long. So like it was a calamity of the guy messing up and Amazon doing kind of one swipe through type of thing. So it's a combination of worst cases.
Yeah, okay, well, that makes sense. But and to be fair, that's not something I've heard a lot about, whereas Amazon account suspension, suspending an ASIN, putting it into hazmat, these are the usual everyday things deal with, right? This is normal. But okay, so ideally then you have the best of both worlds. So you just to summarize this, because I think it's important to just get this message across, something clear and easy to take away. You have your own warehouse of some kind, you send in a week's worth of inventory, so you're mostly in stock in Prime within FBA, and then you've got FBA capability, so you kind of can play both sides. If, for example, the Amazon warehouse houses get shut down by COVID, where your stuff is stored, right? And yep. I would say, if you're in Europe, by the way, I mean, it's not subtle. I read The Economist every week and they have a little sort of COVID update. And the graph for the US has gone sort of up and then down, is kind of gently coming up. The graph for Europe goes up quite a lot, goes down, and then it's just powering up to the sky, like the kind of traditional hockey stick curve that you'd love to see for your sales. And unfortunately, it's infection rates. So I think the chances of FBA centers getting shut down by infection in the UK and Europe have to be large, just statistically. I can't see that a warehouse of 1,000 people or whatever it is, one or two people get infected, they shut it down. I mean, the chances of one person in 1,000 getting infected have to be really high. So I'd just flag that up. It sounds like the statement of the very obvious, but you know, the idea that you can manage without FBM of some kind, I think, is getting harder and harder to justify right now. I mean, how's the situation on the ground in the US, and that, what's your view on that?
Yeah, I think the last article I read, Amazon said it had 10,000 employees who tested positive, and that it's technically, it's below the national average.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting combination. And they've tracked it back to them. Most of them caught it in their households.
Yeah.
And then brought it to work. Not caught it in the warehouse kind of thing. And so they're doing their best. They spent billions of dollars. They were talking about one podcast that I thought was pretty interesting. Yeah. That Jeff Bezos said, I think he said he's spending $2 billion next quarter to help with COVID, to keep people away from each other, to hire more people so they don't have to get near each other, all those kind of things. And that they were saying that he announced it on a quarterly earnings call, $2 more billion. Everyone goes, sounds good. Thanks, Jeff. And that if the Walmart CEO said I was going to spend $2 billion on trying to keep COVID away or Target, they'd be like, what are you talking about? That's our profit margin for the year. This is not how we do business here.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not, what are you talking about? You can't just spend money willy-nilly like that.
Yeah.
Where everyone trusts Jeff so much that they're like, I don't know, build rocket ships with the money. I don't know.
Yeah.
Solve COVID with the money. I don't know.
Right. He has built a lot of trust with investors in his use of cash from years of, to be fair, great success. But yeah, I guess what I'm not saying is I'm not questioning the diligence of the Amazon system. But I'm just saying that statistically, even though that they may well be below the national average, when the national average in the US is maybe different, but in the UK and Europe is going crazy, even if they're below the average, the chances are still quite high of your individual warehouses where your stock happens to be stored getting shut down, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, so yeah, what I'm kind of getting to is that basically for sure you want a merchant fulfilled backup one way or another. But second off, that from what I read and what I had heard from the Amazon fulfillment centers, that like none of them in the US were like shut down due to COVID. It was more that they just had to move painfully slow during COVID, where they couldn't get within 6 feet of each other. So they had to wait for one person to package up the box so the next person could, and all that kind of stuff. And so I see it more just like them getting to a point where it never just shuts down, but it gets to a point where they have half capacity and people are working half as fast. So your orders are taken 7 days instead of 2 days. So that's kind of more I see the trajectory of it going.
That's very interesting, and that's definitely worth knowing about, because I know that at some point in France and Italy, which obviously got very, very badly hit in the first sort of wave of COVID, if there's such a thing as if it ever ended, the first bit of the first wave, if you want to put it that way, they did actually get to the point where they only would fulfill essential items, not just kind of accept them into the warehouse. They kind of cut things to the absolute minimum. So I wonder if that might be coming up, which, as you say, is effectively like a grinding slowdown rather than officially shutting. But okay, so what are your thoughts about the best ways to go about this? Because obviously everyone's scrambling around looking for third-party warehouses because most people don't have the luxury of their own warehouse. And I guess what interests me as well is, in an uncertain world, and I guess this would come to the thinking of Nicholas Nassim Taleb, if that's how you say his name, which I think, by the way, Black Swan by him is required reading for Amazon executives. But the whole thing of like, you've had a legacy warehouse, you know, we were talking in the previous show about old school ways of doing things, and the legacy warehouses looked like a great big overhead that wasn't very profitable. And suddenly it turns out to be a great defensive measure. But if you don't have that luxury, what are the best sort of tactical slash strategic ways to handle that now and over the next period?
Yeah, it kind of just depends on what kind of scale you're at. From even if you're doing like a container, say every quarter, you can fit a container with the stuff in your garage. Like it really kind of just depends on how much of this is your life and how much is your livelihood. Because if you do merchant fulfilled stuff out of your garage for an hour and a half, 2 hours every day, like I've done it before, you can get a lot of orders out in an hour. It's not that big of a deal. So it's like you can do it from that level to the point all the way up to hiring a 3PL and sending your container there first and having them trickle it into Amazon, or doing a combination of you have some at your house, some at the warehouse, some at Amazon's warehouse. It's just, you just need a kind of a little bit more sophisticated inventory management software when you have inventory in multiple different locations that aren't communicating with each other.
Okay, so tell me about your experience of inventory management software. In the previous episode, we talked about the legacy systems. The most crazy example is the one where these guys have a system geared to lumber and they're actually putting normal sort of consumer products through. But assuming that you're starting from scratch in this scenario, the opposite end where you have no system, there's standard stuff out there. What are your sort of do's and don'ts about that, setting that up?
No real do's and don'ts besides just being diligent as heck. When I was last, I had a brand called Bad Boy. So badboy.com, they sell like MMA equipment. That was, we had multiple warehouses and we had everything going on. And yeah, it was just like when you get a purchase order and just really typing in every single inventory number, how much each thing weighs, how much each thing costs, how much you got of each thing, counting each individual t-shirt to make sure you got 20 and not 19, because it was like a weekly basis that we had to go through, count everything, and somehow our count would be off one or two on every single SKU every single time. And I just don't know where the things were going. And so it was just a constant grind of having you kind of just double check your work all the time, even though you're trying to be as diligent as possible the first time. And so you try to do the measure twice, cut once, but it just never turns out that way. So just staying on top of it, being diligent, just never being even close to being lazy, because the second you're lazy, you then have a problem that spurts up 3 months from now and you have no idea why it's happening or what's going on. It's just because you didn't feel like labeling or counting that last stack of t-shirts or something.
And to be fair to Amazon as well, it's very easy to sit there going, oh God, Amazon is a nightmare. When you get one, and I've done this before in all ways, I'm sure we all have, you mislabel something and then it's a nightmare for 3 months. But to be fair to Amazon, I guess whatever system you're using, that is intrinsically a problem. It's a bit like that sort of thing of do things that don't scale. And one of the reasons why is because as soon as you scale, tiny problems become greatly magnified, don't they? Particularly somehow in fulfillment. If you mislabel one product and it gets into the system, that can just create all kinds of havoc. It's crazy, isn't it, how much the results are. So, yeah, being very, very diligent makes a lot of sense. I guess what I've implied is it's easy to make mistakes. So another one, again, it's like how long is a piece of string? But any thoughts about how to deal with when you have got a mislabeled thing or 19 t-shirts instead of 20 or something? How do you troubleshoot that in a multi-channel world?
Yeah, that's the difficult thing, is that, and that's why it's honestly, one tip I'll give is it seems sexy and cool and awesome to have one third-party software that manages your inventory, that does your advertising on Amazon, that does your listing creation, and having one mega software that can kind of do everything. The only issue is when you do have 19 t-shirts instead of 20, you only have one reference point to go back to. Where we had Amazon, we had QuickBooks, we were using something called Stitch Labs as our inventory management system. And then we had like our own spreadsheet of where we were keeping track of our purchase orders and that kind of thing. And so when there was 19 instead of 20, you'd go, okay, there's 20 in our spreadsheet, there's 19 in Stitch Labs, and then there's 20 in Amazon. And you'd be like, why is there one off? And then you start refreshing and looking around, you go, oh, because one has been ordered, but it hasn't been registered yet in Amazon, but it has been registered in our software, or something like that. And you can kind of figure out where the problem is and have some sort of kind of double accounting system to look back at things. And so for me, it's always been helpful to have kind of a Frankenstein, as I mentioned last time, of different collection of Amazon softwares that can kind of balance off each other, opposed to having one mega software that's kind of your Bible. Because if there's something wrong in that one, then you have no backup to kind of double check yourself.
Very interesting. That reminds me, it's a bit of a strange obsession, but I'm into, for some reason, looking back at aviation crashes. It sounds really fetishistic and bad now I say it, but I just find it fascinating that the way that those guys have to do with a smoking piece of metal somewhere
and they have to reverse engineer what happened maybe months or even years ago. And one of the interesting things is that one of the learnings from that is that things like the modern airlines, like the Boeing Max, whatever, have a lot of sensors, and they always have at least two sensors that cross-check each other, preferably three. And to your point, having one data point or one piece of software that may even be wrong, there may be some software glitch, or it may be that something's just out of date. There are two bits of data that don't make sense. Having three reference points, or four, as you say, is something that I think you may have arrived at it by accident through this sort of Frankenstein for Franken software. But I think actually, if you look at the very sophisticated world of building, you know, semi-autonomous planes in a very dangerous environment with a lot of responsibility resting on them, well, their conclusion has become quite simply, we need at least three reference points, and then the computer can compare them. So I think, you know, however you do it, I think that's a really very interesting thought, actually. And I guess that implies then there's got to be a certain sort of manual review of the data at some point. I mean, I know you've said before you prefer sort of blue-collar thinking to kind of creating a SaaS as your default thinking. How do you go about sort of keeping a human handle on things and making sure that you're not just letting the machines run wild?
Now was the nice thing that was before with Exodus, a bad word brand, is that my office was next door to where we had the warehouse. So it was quick enough for me to just be able to go in there. And literally with, once you become comfortable and you know where the things are within the inventory and all that kind of stuff, and you can kind of eyeball things, you can literally walk in there for 30 seconds and be like, hey, where did all the red gloves go? Or where did all these go? Or what's going on with this? And that kind of thing. And then every once in a while, you'd go and you would replenish an order, and it would say you have four gloves left. And you're like, okay, perfect. I got four gloves left. I'm going to send one out. And then you go back to where the red gloves are, and there's only two of them sitting there. And then it's like, oh, looks like I just found a problem. And then I go and crank out all these numbers and figure out, okay, it's just that we sent two gloves to a person that we were using as an influencer on Instagram, and we never took them out of stock because they never bought them. So we need to find a way to create a $0 order that takes it out of stock but doesn't add any revenue. And so it's just kind of the stuff like that just pops up day after day. And that after a couple months of doing it, you go, okay, now we've figured out what the 10 most main problems are, and here's our process for solving each one of them.
Perfect. So again, I guess for me, there are two lessons from that. One is getting as hands-on as you can, which could be difficult if you're using a third-party warehouse. And especially that becomes amplified if, as a lot of people do, they live in the UK or Europe, as a lot of our clients in the masterminds these days, but they're selling in the US a lot, then of course they cannot physically walk next door. I mean, it would be insane. So you have to have somebody trusted on the ground. But the second thing that strikes me is really, again, this do things that don't scale thing is to find all the problems at a really small scale and do very manual and literally manual hands-on if you can, but certainly, you know, piece by piece if you can't. And then once you've nailed down the common problems, then to scale up at that point, which is very interesting because that goes against everything we're taught by all this software advertising. It's like scale easily, click a button and then go and have coffee all day.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just my experience or what, but like when I hear the concept of people like getting a container from China and sending it directly to FBA, that like gives me so much anxiety. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But like I've had containers show up and every box is crushed. You know, like, it's like, what do you do then? You got this container at this fulfillment center. Amazon wants it gone. Like, you don't have any, like, what are you talking about? Like, that's just crazy. And so I get it would be sweet that you just order a container a quarter, goes directly to FBA, you sit in Thailand, drink all your coconuts. But it tends to, yeah, I rarely hear it working that smoothly.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say, because I remember big discussions, aka not quite arguments, but were more gentlemanly, that it's a bunch of British Amazon sellers, but some pretty serious people. One guy was doing, I think, $500,000 a month in revenue at that point, and he's gone on to pass the $1 million a month revenue at some point. And he was importing containers direct from China. So UK-based guy, lives in London, but his factory was in China, and they were fronting quite a lot of the money. So he's a sophisticated guy and shipping containers direct to Amazon in the US. And they'd made the judgment call that doing a sort of breakpoint in between where you do a post-shipment inspection was actually not needed. But I guess to be fair to them, by that point, they'd had their problems. They'd probably done post-shipment inspections, discovered that stuff was getting crushed or, you know, breaking. And they'd gone back to the manufacturer and really been very, very meticulous about the packaging side of things. And, you know, for example, just the details of reinforcing the corners, reinforcing the edges of the boxes, thicker material for the boxes, all the stuff that you have to bully the Chinese factories to do because they'll save a cent and cost you 50 you know, $50 million or whatever. That was cost you a lot of money and hassle. So to be fair, it wasn't just like he hadn't done it in an unmeticulous way. He was a very meticulous guy. But nevertheless, they come to the conclusion that that was the right move. And so I guess they must have made a sort of cost-benefit analysis. I would say for anyone starting out that I would never, ever, any client of mine working with me, like, I'm going to refuse to work with you if you don't break it and do a post-shipment inspection for the first time out for a new supplier or a new designer product, because it's just asking for trouble.
Yeah, I think of it always too from just like the stress threshold.
Quite.
Of like, mine's very small. Like, I just want to never be stressed out ever. Mm. And so like, I pay for insurance for everything, you know? And so it's that kind of mindset of like, we can get through life not paying for insurance for anything and be fine and save a bunch of money. Or like for me, it's like, I just think of it as like the like 5% sleep easy tax. That I know nothing can go wrong and nothing can burn down because I've already paid my tax of making sure nothing catastrophic happens.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make. And I think for me, I'm also the person that would pay the insurance and pay for the post-shipment inspection. And the other thing I would say is this, that two things. Number one is if your profit margin is so thin that you can't do things in a really professional, consistent way, you have a big, big problem with the model for that particular product line anyway, possibly for your business as a whole. And the second thing is, it's not just you that needs to sleep easy. If you ever want to create a saleable asset, whether you own it in future or somebody else, it's going to be really hard to sell something that has really nasty downward spikes in revenue or profit, I guess, or upward spikes in problem sort of Amazon account health or any other sort of anywhere else you're measuring in the system. Because I imagine that the person buying the business also wants to sleep well at night, right? So there's a lot to be said for allowing the margins for post-shipment inspection, for insurance, what have you. But yeah, very interesting. So we got into the sort of wider logistics chain there, I suppose, the supply chain. So bringing it back a little bit more to the logistics and fulfillment side, what are your sort of takeaways from this episode? That we cover quite a range of stuff here. What do you think for people, let's say in Q4 2020, but also going into Q1, Q2 2021, what are your sort of takeaways for people around fulfillment?
Yeah, and this kind of just segues basically back to what we were just saying, is that have an insurance policy. We don't know when COVID's going to be over. We know the holidays are going to be crazy. We don't know when the fulfillment centers are going to be grinded to a halt or shut down, or we don't know anything. And so if you have a merchant fulfilled possibility, then you at least have some sort of insurance policy if something catastrophic happens.
Pretty simple takeaway, but interesting to think about through. And also, I think what I'm taking from you is have a very manual process to start with, as manual as you can get, actually. Make it almost not a fetish of it, but multiple touch points in your software such that you can just troubleshoot. Because I think one of the terrible things that we fall into is that Amazon's made it so easy to scale quickly and with a pretty low error rate, even though it feels different when you're on the end of it. Amazon does a pretty accurate job. That I think we've been seduced into the idea that fulfillment is easy, and it really isn't. As you said, you know, just four gloves instead of two. That's just like a microcosm of how it can get, right? So,
100%.
Yeah, great to get a bit of a reality check on that. And again, just to reference that great quote, Paul Graham, do things that don't scale. To start with, at least. And then you can scale when you got it working. So, look, Will, very thought-provoking as ever. Many, many thanks for coming back on the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the 10K Collective podcast, part of the family of amazing FBA podcasts. Today's episode is sponsored by the new e-commerce podcast, The E-Commerce Leader. The podcast is hosted by yours truly and Jason Miles, multi-million dollar Shopify owner and Unami's highest rated e-commerce instructor. If you're the owner of a thriving online business and you want to become the best e-commerce leader you can be, it's got your name on it. For free guides and mini courses on many topics, go to www.theecommerceleader.com.